Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
It's a hard week when you're the same week after the accident.
A wrongful death lawsuit is filed over last year's fatal Bering airplane crash. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, February 5th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, budget crunchers weigh in on Governor Dunleavy's plan to fix the state's fiscal problem.
At no point do any of these things add up to get to a balanced budget.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
The PFD application is open. Just a small amount of your PFD will help share local news and stories about Alaskans with Alaskans across this great state when you choose Alaska Public Media through Pick, Click, Give.
The family of one of the victims who died in a Bering Air plane crash last year is suing the regional airline. The news comes a day before the anniversary of the crash, which killed all 10 people on board and shook communities in northwest Alaska. Bering Air Flight 445 was on its regularly scheduled route from Unalakleet to Nome when it crashed about 30 miles southeast of Nome. J.D. Moncur was one of the passengers. His family filed a wrongful death lawsuit in Nome Superior Court today. Casey DeBaus is an attorney with Aviation Law Group, which is based in Seattle and represents the family.
It's a hard week when you're the same week after the accident, but as we've done our investigation, we have enough evidence and we decided it's time to get moving forward with this litigation so that their family can get answers and some justice out of this terrible incident.
The National Transportation Safety Board has not released its full investigation into the crash, but a preliminary report found that the Cessna Caravan was almost 1,000 pounds overweight when it flew into icing conditions. The lawsuit alleges that led to the crash and that it flew without adequate safeguards for the situation. DeBaus says those allegations are based on the NTSB's preliminary report and an independent investigation by the law group. J.D. Moncur was 52 years old. His family said he was born in Wyoming and moved to Alaska in 2008. Moncur worked as a project engineer and lived in Eagle River. He's survived by his wife and 3 adult children. The family said in a written statement that they appreciate the outpouring of support they have received throughout the year. They also said they chose to pursue the lawsuit to seek accountability and contribute to greater aviation safety. Bering Air did not respond to a request for comment today. NTSB officials say they anticipate the final investigation into the crash to be released in early summer. Alaska's waters could open to seafloor mineral mining. The federal government is seeking input on what could be the first lease sale of its kind. KUCB's Sophia Stewart Rossi reports.
The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management is evaluating whether to hold a lease sale for seabed mineral development in federal waters off Alaska. The federal agency is seeking information and input to help decide if it should move forward. The request covers specific areas of Alaska's federal offshore waters, including around most of the Aleutian Islands. The request also says the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management is interested in areas where the U.S. Geological Survey has identified potential for critical minerals. In Alaska, those could include cobalt, nickel, and rare earth elements. According to the federal agency, which is part of the U.S. Department of Interior, the goal is to, quote, strengthen U.S. energy security and supply chains, shorten delivery lines, and keep jobs and investments here at home. End quote. The move comes as the Trump administration has signed orders aimed at speeding up the development of energy and critical minerals. If the agency decides to proceed, federal law requires environmental analysis and additional steps, but it would be the first mineral lease sale in Alaska's offshore waters. Scientists have already been working to identify what minerals might be on the Aleutian seabed. A U.S. Geological Survey team searched the region last summer, but data on what minerals they found hasn't been released yet. What scientists did find, however, were thriving coral and sponge communities on the Aleutian seafloor, which may be vulnerable to disturbances from resource extraction. Comments on whether to hold a lease sale can be submitted online. The deadline is March 2nd at midnight Eastern Time. In Unalaska, I'm Sophia Stewart Rossi.
Alaska's state government remains in search of a solution to its long-running budget problems. The problem is simple. The state spends more than it takes in. The solution? Well, not so simple. Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone reports.
If you ask Governor Mike Dunleavy, a lot of the state's problems come back to the budget process. Every year, lawmakers gather in Juneau for 4 months and spend much of that time debating how the state should spread around its limited funds. How much for education, how much for public safety, and for the last decade or so, how much the permanent fund dividend should be. Meanwhile, much of the state's revenue depends on the constantly swinging price of oil. Dunleavy says investors who might otherwise bring jobs and new residents to the state have noticed.
This volatile budgetary process has negatively impacted our ability to recruit investment to the state. It has retarded our GDP growth. It has caused deep fractures within this body and within other relationships. And it leads to uncertainty in funding for critical programs.
He said that in his State of the State speech, days before filing a series of bills outlining a fiscal plan that he says would make the budget more stable by boosting revenue and cutting expenses. Most of the money it would raise would come from a sales tax, 4% in the summer, 2% in the winter. The plan would also hike oil taxes and capture more money from outside businesses. It would all be temporary, 5 to 7 years, and at the end, corporate income taxes would vanish entirely. On the expense side, it would put a 1% cap on state spending growth every year. That is not adjusted for inflation, so if inflation runs more than 1%, state spending shrinks. And it would also take the permanent fund dividend out of the state's annual budget debates by putting it and a new formula into the state constitution. Plug that into the state budget and, well...
At no point do any of these things add up to get to a balanced budget.
Neil Steininger crunched the numbers for the Alaska Political Report, an insidery subscription newsletter. It probably helps that he's a former budget director for Dunleavy. Steininger says, for one thing, Dunleavy's plan would fully drain the state's $3 billion rainy day fund by 2033 or 2034, not exactly resolving the state's budget issues. But for another thing, Steininger says the effect of the changes would ultimately make the state's revenue just as volatile, if not more, exactly what Dunleavy is trying to avoid. As a result of Dunleavy's proposed formula for dividends, which would take half of the state's annual draw from the permanent fund and split it 50-50 between state services and dividends. Steininger says the fact that so much reliable, stable investment revenue would be tied to dividends would make the state more dependent on the price of oil.
That's a position we've been in already. You know, that's actually nothing new. It's just really cementing that into the Constitution.
The governor has repeatedly declined interviews on his plans, but his projections are substantially rosier. They show a slight surplus in the early 2030s before returning to large deficits. But the governor's office still projects the plan would draw down half of the rainy day fund over 10 years. Dunleavy says revenue from things like a boom in oil drilling or a new gas pipeline would help the budget balance in the long term. But Steininger says those don't show up in state economists' projections. And so far, the plan has landed in Juneau with a thud. Speaker of the House Bryce Edgman, a Dillingham independent, says he's not optimistic about its chances.
Back of the envelope would suggest that the governor's plan in its totality would actually increase our problem. It would not lessen it.
Even Dunleavy's traditional allies are skeptical. The Republican House Minority Leader called his plan incomplete. But where does that leave state leaders' search for a solution? Edgman and his Senate counterpart say they're intrigued by what they recently heard from a panel of University of Alaska Anchorage economists. They studied a wide variety of options at the request of the governor. Senate President Gary Stevens, a Kodiak Republican, says he was interested in the economists' conclusion that raising taxes on corporations and oil and gas would have the smallest impact on the state's economy.
The impact on people, it's much more stressful on folks to have a sales tax or an income tax, easier to accumulate a little higher tax on the industry.
But in the last year of Dunleavy's term, Stephen says it might be too late for this governor to solve the problem. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Eric Stone.
The House Finance Committee is taking public testimony on Dunleavy's tax bill tonight. Find more information at akleg.gov. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a preview and personal anecdotes from Olympians with Alaska connections.
I went to my parents and I was like, yo, I'm going to Fairbanks. And they're like, where is that? And I was like, Alaska. Can we book a flight?
That's ahead. Stay with us.
I'm Shelby Herbert, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media and KUAC, where I work in Fairbanks, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Haines, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news, Alaska News Nightly, or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
A state judge ruled Tuesday that two of Alaska's largest news organizations and two top reporters did not commit defamation when they described a former state employee's statements about rape. The Alaska Beacon reports that Jeremy Kubis, a former aide to Governor Mike Dunleavy, sued reporters Nat Herz and Curtis Gilbert last year, along with the Anchorage Daily News and Alaska Public Media. American Public Media, a national organization, was also named in the suit. Kubis resigned in 2023, shortly before the publication of an article that described comments he made in two podcast episodes. He filed suit almost 2 years later, seeking more than $5 million in damages and lost wages. Kubis specifically challenged two parts of the article, a paraphrase that quoted Kubis saying, quote, "It's fine for a man to force himself on his wife," and a statement that Kubis made comments about rape. Judge Christina Rankin concluded that the article was accurate and dismissed the suit. By text message, Kubis said he will have more to say later, but that he was working on an appeal. The Fairbanks North Star Borough Assembly last week approved tax incentives for new multifamily housing construction, like apartments. Borough Mayor Grier Hopkins' administration put forward the ordinance, which exempts some types of new residential construction from borough property taxes for up to 10 years. That's if a developer constructs five or more units, each with at least two bedrooms at the same address. The ordinance also includes breaks for smaller multifamily developments, but with shorter tax exemption terms. The Hopkins administration says it's needed to encourage residential developments. The administration says that would help ease an existing housing crunch, which could get worse as additional service members head to Fort Wainwright and Eielson Air Force Base over the next couple years. Tom Hewitt, the special assistant to the borough mayor, says it's an issue that warrants policy intervention.
More housing anywhere and everywhere would help, but especially in Badger Road, North Pole area, stuff that's convenient to both bases. And the planned military growth at those bases will constrain supply further, so this is a problem that we can't afford to just assume will fix itself.
Location is a criteria for eligibility. To qualify for the tax breaks, new housing construction must be in a so-called military facility zone in City of Fairbanks or North Pole boundaries, or in an area, quote, suitable for high-density residential development, as described in the ordinance. The measure is modeled after a similar tax incentive program that ran under the administration of former Borough Mayor Bryce Ward in 2022 and 2023. The Hopkins administration says that program successfully increased multifamily housing construction and that the new measure revives it with a few tweaks based on feedback from builders. The measure received strong support during public testimony, though commenters frequently said it's a partial solution, not a cure-all. Here's Katie Yarrow, the president of the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce.
The housing issue is larger than could simply be contained in this ordinance. So we are recognizing that this is a meaningful step forward. And we just want to consider this a piece in a larger puzzle.
The Assembly amended the measure slightly to loosen some restrictions concerning water supply to qualifying developments, then passed the ordinance unanimously. It went into effect Friday. The application window for the exemptions closes at the end of 2028. On Monday, a Juneau jazz musician canceled a show that was meant to be a part of a festival in town this week. The show was advertised as a fundraiser for the ACLU of Alaska, but the organization that planned the festival said they didn't agree to that. KTOO's Yvonne Crumry reports.
Spencer Edgars plays the saxophone with other local musicians in the Dream Band. Juneau Jazz and Classics tapped his band to play a show during their annual jazz fest in town. But recent national events, like immigration enforcement ramping up efforts and shooting civilians, led him to decide to approach this show differently.
Knowing I had this show coming up, I personally felt uncomfortable promoting a show, taking up bandwidth on the internet during a time where people are sharing resources and looking out for each other.
So Edgars decided to make the show a fundraiser for the ACLU of Alaska. The rest of his band were on board, and he cleared it with the venue, the Alaskan Hotel and Bar, which was paying the band.
the plan was to, you know, have our tip jar, pass it around to people. The tip jar was going to go to the organization.
He also planned to pass around flyers with links to report immigration enforcement activity and resources for forming safety plans. But Edgars didn't clear it with Juno Jazz and Classics. He said the organization hadn't really been communicating about the event.
I assumed that they would not have a problem with it and did not seek the consent for that collaboration.
Edgars says festival leadership called him and expressed concerns about bringing politics into the festival. But interim director Alex Serio said a fear of political pushback was not a part of Juno Jazz and Classics concerns.
This went to the board, and the board decided that we've never had any outside fundraisers before.
And Serio says the board also expressed frustration at not being informed of the fundraising aspect. But if Edgars chose to ask for donations for the ACLU on stage and not in advertising, that would have been his right.
Everybody has freedom of speech. Everybody can voice what they believe in, and we respect that.
But the organization's board didn't want their branding on the same poster that advertised an ACLU fundraiser.
We just didn't want the two of them together saying that we formally endorse an outside fundraiser.
So the board asked Edgars to remove its logo from the poster, but said he could carry on with the show.
I think the board hoped that there would be a compromise, that he would still be able to ask people and he would still play and we could still include community members, but he decided to do it independently, and we totally support that.
But Edgar said continuing without the organization's support didn't feel right, and he canceled the performance.
I would have not felt good about compromising my values in this way. I would not have felt good with going through with it.
He posted about the cancellation on his personal Facebook account, and the post garnered dozens of comments, some from local musicians and artists, in support of his decision and admonishing the organizations. Edgar says he understands that he sprung the change on Juno Jazz and Classics at the last minute, and he says he plans to communicate earlier in any future shows. But he also wants the board to consider the organization's role in the Juno community, and that protest is inherent to jazz.
One of the things I encouraged them to do was to reflect on the history of the music and the nature of it and how it was born out of adversity and originated basically as protest music.
And Serio says Juno Jazz and Classics will have conversations about that history more in the coming months. The Dream Band still plans to hold a fundraiser for the ACLU of Alaska sometime next month. In Juno, I'm Yvonne Crumry.
The state's proposed Cascade Point Ferry Terminal has received hundreds of comments from Southeast residents who say they want to see the ferry system work for travelers, not private mines. More than 90% of the comments reject building a second terminal in Juneau, farther from the city center and roughly 30 miles north of the existing Auk Bay Ferry Terminal. The comment period and a highly criticized economic analysis came after the state already signed a $28 million contract for the first phase of construction set to begin this summer. Leaders in Skagway and Haines oppose the project. Members of the Alaska Marine Highway Operations Board have questioned the motives behind it and said it doesn't fit into their long-range plan. The Juneau Assembly hasn't taken an official stance on the state's plan, but Assemblymember Maureen Hall submitted a comment. She wrote that she opposes the, quote, use of public funds to construct a remote state of Alaska ferry terminal when the facility's apparent primary purpose is to function as an ore dock for private industry, end quote, and that it, quote, represents a blatant misuse of public resources. 33 commenters called the project a boondoggle outright. Hundreds wrote that building a second terminal in Juneau doesn't solve the problems that the state's ferry system faces, including an aging fleet, crew shortages, reduced sailings, and a lack of funding. Just under 50 people commented in favor of Cascade Point. Among them were mining leaders at Core Alaska's Kensington Mine and Grand Portage Resources, which commented that they would benefit from the transportation services. The Winter Olympics are set to kick off with a torch lighting in Milan, Italy this weekend. Team USA obviously will be in attendance, but at least as far as the sport of cross-country skiing is concerned, it might as well be called Team Alaska, given how many of the athletes have ties to our state. Anchorage-based reporter Nat Herz is in Italy to cover the games and joins us for a preview of some of the interesting storylines to follow. Hi, Nat.
Buongiorno, Casey.
Buongiorno. So, Nat, the Winter Olympics obviously are a whole bunch of different sports, but you're there pretty much exclusively focused on cross-country skiing. Why is that?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty straightforward. You know, we've got a few Olympians from Alaska competing in other sports. NHL hockey goalie Jeremy Swayman, biathlete Maxime Germain. But most of the Alaska athletes competing are in cross country, half of the 16-person U.S. team, plus a couple more racing for other countries. You know, the geographic nature of this Olympics, sometimes they're sort of a little more compact with venues like all in one sort of city or mountain town. But in this case, they're spread across like 150 miles of northern Italy with huge mountain ranges in the way. It took me 5.5 hours or 6 hours to get here up in the mountains from Milan yesterday on a series of trains and a coach bus that almost made me throw up. So I'm staying here.
That makes sense. Yeah, Roger that. So 16 cross-country skiers total, 8 from Alaska. Who will you be following most closely?
Yeah, we'll start with the biggest name, Gus Schumacher, who is a familiar face to, I think, many people who are just like out on the trails in Anchorage at Kincaid Park. Gus grew up in Anchorage. I interviewed him for the first time when he was racing against adults at national championships at Kincaid Park when he was 13 years old. I think his coach said he was weighed less than his dog at that time. Gus is now 25. He's a world junior champion a few years ago and is now one of the very best cross-country skiers in the world. He was on the podium last month racing against effectively all the same people that will be competing here in Italy. Gus is still young. He's not exactly a regular on the podium, so he's not like a lock for a medal by any means, but there's a real chance he could become only the 4th ever American to win an Olympic medal in cross-country skiing in the next couple weeks, and he's strong in a number of the different events that are on the table here.
Yeah, Gus Schumacher, you mentioned Kincaid Park. I'm pretty sure Gus passed me one time. I was huffing and puffing going up a hill, and he just was like cruising, no problem, kind of looked over. Gus Schumacher, we will remember that name. Who else are you following?
Not that many of the other athletes, I think, really are likely to medal, but they each really have their own kind of stories and journeys to get here. Two that I think are interesting are Haley Swerble and Hunter Wonders. Haley grew up in Colorado, moved up to Alaska to train with the Alaska Pacific University club team. Hunter's also on that team, grew up in Alaska. Both of them were really strong at an early age and were really dedicating their whole lives to top-level skiing and experienced real success. Haley made it on the podium at a top-level World Cup race. She went to the Olympics in 2022. Hunter was nearly at the same level, but also neither of them was really having very much fun on the road in Europe, being away from home, being away from friends, loved ones, family. So they both retired in their early mid-20s, which is kind of wild. There were some people who I think were really disappointed to see this happening, especially with Haley, who just had, you know, so much potential. But both of them, after taking some space and kind of finding some peace with the sport, have come back to it on their own terms and are doing it a slightly different way from some of their peers who maybe find it a little easier to be laser focused on this one pursuit. Haley last winter was patrolling at an alpine ski area, and this year was coaching cross-country skiing in Anchorage before she made a decision over the summer to try for a comeback. And now she's here at the Olympics.
Yeah, it's super cool. I mean, again, in Anchorage, you see these people around. I actually just saw Haley maybe 3 weeks ago before they named the Olympic ski team. And, you know, just interesting to think like she's over there now competing. Nat, anybody else that you're following?
Well, yeah, in addition to these Team USA Alaska athletes, we also have another couple skiers with Alaska ties who will be racing in Italy for other countries. One is Rosie Fordham. She has a wild story where she grew up in Australia and kind of randomly got into cross-country skiing, even though she grew up in Sydney, really far from snow. She then cold emailed like literally dozens of U.S. college programs and got maybe 3 responses, including one from the coach at University of Alaska Fairbanks, who offered her a scholarship. Rosie Fordham spoke on a podcast I taped with her earlier this winter.
All right, sounds good. Sure. Yeah, I want to get out of Australia. I went to my parents and I was like, yo, I'm going to Fairbanks. And they're like, where is that? And I was like, Alaska. Can we book a flight? And they were like, yeah.
Fordham does some really cool and unconventional training sessions in Alaska. She goes wild ice skating. One time she cross-country skied the full 135-mile Denali Highway in one day. But it really seems to be working for her. She's placed in the top 15 against the best in the world this season.
Wow, that is cool. An Australian ends up skiing for UAF and then in the Olympics.
All right, Nat, wrap it up for us. Anything else?
Well, one other thing that's fun, you'll be able to hear Anchorage resident and past Olympic gold medal winning cross-country skier, now retired Keegan Randall, helping call some of the races on NBC's national broadcast. Keegan, of course, became an Olympic champion in the team sprint in South Korea at the 2018 Olympics. Beyond that, Casey, I am not going to tell you about the pizza or the focaccia or the tortellini. You'll probably be mad.
Yeah. All right. That was Nat Herz, who's reporting on the Winter Olympics from Italy. He will be back to talk to us more about the Olympics. You can find his work all over the place, including at our website, alaskapublic.org. Nat, have fun. Thanks for being here.
Grazie mille, Casey.
Grazie.
The 2026 Winter Olympics officially kick off with the opening ceremony tomorrow at 10 a.m. Alaska time. The games run through February 22nd. You can find the full schedule at olympics.com. The website will stream some events live and feature some highlights and recaps. You can also watch the games on some cable networks or with a subscription to the streaming service Peacock. If you want to catch the Alaska skiers live, you're going to have to get up early. Nordic ski competitions start at 3 a.m. on Saturday and 2:30 a.m. on Sunday. Find more at alaskapublic.org. And that is all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Alyona Niden in Anchorage, Sophia Stewart-Rossi in Unalaska, Eric Stone, Yvonne Crumry, and Alex Solomon in Juneau, Patrick Gilchrist in Fairbanks, and Nat Herz eating his way through Italy. Our audio engineer is Crystal Hyde. Kirsten Dobroth is our producer. I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.